Hi, this is Gary Rogowski for Creativity, Hustlers, Fakers, and Thieves. I am pleased and honored to have as my guest, Patrick Edwards. Hello, Patrick. How are you?
Glad to see you. Glad to be here.
Great.
So, what's on the agenda?
Oh, a little conversation. And, you know, we try out some stuff and talk about... I've been very interested in this idea of creativity for a while. And how it affects certain people. You're a creative person. I try to be, and I know people who want to be and can't seem to find the trigger.
I would object to you calling me creative because I'm basically a counterfeiter. I don't come up with new ideas. I haven't had a new idea in years. I counterfeit good ideas that I've seen other people do in the past. I don't know if that's a learning process actually as a technique, but the fact is, if you ask me to freehand draw an image that I had in my mind, I couldn't do it. Or freehand play some music without the score, I couldn't do it. Or come up with some creative idea. You know, anything I come up with would be 100% embedded previous ideas.
Absolutely.
That's why I don't do contemporary furniture. If I did a contemporary piece, it would look like something Wendell Castle did or Maloof did or any Tate Fridge or any of the guys I know exist doing contemporary furniture. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't be mine, you know, because I don't have it.
I believe that. Okay. All right.
That's the challenge for you. Prove I'm a creative person.
Here's a quote. I my browser opens every morning to a site by a guy named Anu Garg. He's up in Seattle, and it's called Word a Day. And so this is a quote from John W. Gardner, author and leader. Never heard of him. We must learn to honor excellence in every socially accepted human activity, however humble the activity, and to scorn shoddiness, however exalted the activity. An excellent plumber is infinitely more admirable than an incompetent philosopher. The society that scorns excellence in plumbing because plumbing is a humble activity and tolerates shoddiness in philosophy because it is an exalted activity will have neither good plumbing nor good philosophy. Neither its pipes nor its theories will hold water.
That's the metaphor.
Yeah. And that's I think that a plumber needs to be creative. That's my broad definition of creative. You get faced with a problem. You're under the sink. You only have these tools with you. You need to solve the problem.
Yeah.
Fine.
Well, problem solving, I can understand that being a challenge that's solved by creative thinking. Absolutely. That's something I face every day when I fix a broken chair or some other object that's been badly repaired and poorly designed. Mm-hmm. Because you can only do so much with a bad design. It's going to fail no matter what you do.
Right.
And if you have the parameters of a furniture conservator, everything has to be within those limits of originality and intent and aesthetic appeal. And so you are constrained by those parameters, and still you have to make it work. You know, the client wants to sit in the chair.
Right.
And the client weighs 350 pounds and likes to lean back after dinner with a drink. So, you know, that is the extent of my creativity. In a design field, I got zero. I know good design when I see it. It's like pornography. I know it when I see it. And I have a great eye for great design. And the pieces I've made that have got me all this fame, those were great pieces to begin with that I just copied.
Mm-hmm. There is a whole branch of art called classical music.
Yeah.
And there's not a handful of people who improvise classical music.
That's me. I play classical music. I'm in an orchestra, and I can't. If you take the music away, I can't play.
Right. And that's not a creative act?
Well, no, that's reading words out of a great book. You have a Dickens in front of you and you can read the words. It's no different than putting Tchaikovsky in front of you and you play the music.
Yes, but...
I mean, you can put inflection into the words. You can put tone and all that. Same thing with music.
So how large is your orchestra that you play?
Oh, it's 60 people. It's a big orchestra.
Big orchestra. And there's a woodwind section. There's a string.
Yeah. We got bassoons. We got timpani. We got the whole thing. I'm in the viola section. Kristen's in the cello section.
Uh-huh.
And we sit 5 feet apart.
And my point is that effort, which I consider to be a creative one, is different on a different scale than if it were a kazoo band, let's say.
I mean,
you change the music by how it's played. The music is changed by the director.
However, you take a good jazz group, they're improvisational. They're playing jazz licks that they put together and it's not written down, but they all end up at the same point.
Right.
Because they understand the jazz.
It's practice though.
Yeah.
Some of it does come at the moment, a note here or there, and it may be a phrase, but the improvisation is also practice. I don't think it's.
Well, I'll tell you this, both of those exercises take a risk. And going back to Pi, my life has been the workmanship of risk, and music is a great example of taking a risk, especially if you're playing an instrument with no frets.
Right.
You put your finger down, it's sharp or flat. That's a risk.
Right. So you just referred to David Pye.
Yeah.
And his book,
The Nature and Art of Workmanship.
Right. Which was his second book, I think.
It was 1968.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. We're in my online mastery group, we're talking about The Nature and Aesthetics of Design, which was his first book. There's a lot of risk involved in being on stage. I always loved the quote by Yo-Yo Ma saying he didn't relax until he had made his first mistake on stage. And no one would notice.
Yeah, well.
Kristen wouldn't notice. Or if she did, she would go, oh, that's Yo-Yo Ma. You let that go.
Yeah.
Who was it? Oh, it was Fred Astaire who said, you know, when you get to be a certain age, your mistakes become your style.
That's a good point. Yeah.
Yeah, that really is true.
However, a flat note is still a flat note.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Although I thought I heard one. I'm listening to the Beethoven sonatas and Alfred Brendel. Boy, I just thought, that didn't sound right, man. Now, I don't know. But it just didn't sound right to me. I didn't know
that Beethoven.
10 hours of sonatas. I had no idea. Recorded.
Listen to all the quartets, first, second, and third groups by the Guarneri. That's something I do every day.
Really?
The Beethoven quartets played by the Guarneri. They had a 2, 4, 6, 8 CD early, middle, and late quartets of Beethoven. They did the entire series. And very few quartets have done the whole series.
Because?
It's a lot of work and it's challenging. Some of those are, the Grosse Fugue is incredibly difficult to play.
Huh.
And not many quartets live together long enough to be able to master the entire series.
No kidding.
But
And here we go. What do you think it takes to master a playing a Beethoven quartet? Wouldn't it be precision?
No, it's more intimate than that.
Huh?
When you're in a quartet, you breathe together. You understand each other's movements. Just peripheral vision and everything comes into account. How do you phrase everything sympathetically with the other people? There's only three other voices with you.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't stand out. You can't disappear. You have to be equal. So as the emotion of the piece rises and falls, everybody has to understand it. And you don't realize it unless you've played in a quartet, but they begin breathing together. And you hear among the group, not in the audience, but among the group, you'll hear the cellist go, and that's your way of knowing that he's ready to come in, and you respond to that. It's the most intimate thing I've ever seen.
Interesting.
In a public stage.
Yeah.
Now, quartet.
Yeah, in a jazz improvisation piece. I'm sure it's sort of a return.
Oh, it's just like, right. Yeah, because they and it's louder and they can't really hear each other breathe, but
right.
They can cue on elements of traditional jazz, chord changes, things that they hear the other guys doing, and mm-hmm. and they're experienced enough to respond to that.
Right.
But in a quartet, you can hear the guy next to you breathe.
I think you're arguing my point, and I want to thank you for that.
Like minds, you know.
I feel that when I first started, I tried to be so precise. I would spend a half an hour setting up my joiner. Mm. And now I look at it and go, yeah, okay, whatever. I barely set things up because I know how to fix things.
Yeah.
And I also know a couple little tricks about that tool. So I'm more precise as I've gotten older and sloppier. It's interesting. You're trying so hard when you first start out to be, you know, gnat's ass perfect, and it's impossible. You just don't know enough.
I never had that experience.
No,
I was just like, let's get it done. How is it done? Let's do it. And I used to tell people the difference, because I lectured an awful lot, and mm-hmm. I would tell people the difference between an amateur and a professional is they both make mistakes, but the professional knows how to fix it. Mm-hmm. And that's just what you suggested is, you just, in the enthusiasm of trying to do something, everybody makes mistakes.
Sure.
And the amateur is like, well, I goofed it. I'm going to take it to a professional and have them fix it, because it's out of my control. But a professional says, I understand from the mistake, I can learn from this, and I'll know how to fix it. So for you setting up your jointer, early on, I would take my chisel over to the stone and swipe it three times and get back to work.
Right. Now, we were talking about getting a square cut.
Right, right.
Yeah, that's barely an issue for me now. I mean, I still want a square cut sometimes, but freckle. Well,
like Pi says, I think I've told you my summary of Pi. The simplistic approach to those two choices of risk and certainty is the relationship between the worker, the tool, and the material, which are the three things that are involved. And so with Pi, the worker holds the tool and pushes it against the material. With certainty, you hold the material and feed it into the tool. And so the relationship is changed, which means in my world, you pick up a back saw or a chisel or any kind of tool like that. You have to master the tool, which is in your hand. Mm-hmm. For me, it's installing upholstery tacks on an 18th century Bergier chair along the edge of the gilded frame, where I have to hammer the tacks in without hitting the frame,
right.
Without hitting the gold or right. My fingers or something like that.
Your fingers are probably preferable to hitting the gold.
So for that example, a lot of people don't know how to hit hammer. Everybody uses a hammer. You see it on TV, you see it in movies. I think immediately the guy does not understand a hammer. It's a simple tool, but the more variables you put into the hammering, the more likely it is you're going to miss the nail. So an upholstery hammer has a curved head, which mm-hmm. is the radius that you have to have for the arc, which uh-huh. means you hold your arm against your body and your pivot point is your wrist.
Right.
And that eliminates any other deviation for the hammering. Now, that's completely different for carpentry, where your arm becomes the right. radius. But, right. but people, they don't understand a simple tool like a hammer and the physics of how the damn thing works properly, you know, and they end up hitting their fingers. or missing the nail or something.
Or missing the nail or bending it.
Yeah, like driving, again, back to upholstery, driving brass tacks, which are round, into the frame with a hammer. You have to be aware of where you're hitting the tack so that if it starts to bend and go off course, you can correct it as you drive it. That's a talent that is risky, but I've mastered that so much now that I can do it in my sleep.
Right. A very precise stroke. And sometimes I find I'm swinging to the side.
Yeah, see, that's why you put your arm tight on you and you just do
to influence the nail once it starts to go south on you. I find that there are so many similarities between different fields of endeavor and this need for precision in, but I think sloppy work shows, and
it'll fail.
I hate it. I can't let it out of my shop. I refuse.
It's not just a crime against aesthetic design. It's going to fail.
It may not fail.
I mean, a
little bit earlier, but still.
Here's another quote for you. If you don't have time to do it, if you don't have time to do it right, when will you have time to do it over?
That's a good one. That's a good one.
That goes back to my physics days.
Oh, yeah. My quote these days is, slow down, I'm in a hurry. That usually helps, because when I'm speeding up, then bad things happen. You are a historian, trained conservator in the Boule technique of marquetry.
Yep. I think I'm my partner and I are the best in this country for French marquetry techniques. Mm-hmm. I think we are. Me, I just tell people I'm a furniture conservator in private practice, which leaves it open to whatever I want it to be.
Right.
But furniture conservation is my business.
Do you work with museums?
I work for museums, but not mm-hmm. I'm not employed by them. Uh-huh. That's where the independent practice comes in.
Right. I just watched this movie I had heard about, but I'd never seen. The Red Violin.
Oh, it's a good movie. I'm glad they did it in so many different languages.
I liked it all the way up to the end. I did not like the ending.
It's a hypothetical movie. They wanted to do something.
Oh, of course,
Hollywood, you know.
But it made me wonder, what if I did put some blood in my shellac?
No, don't do that.
Well, I'm usually bleeding anyway. So.
Dragon's blood. You can use dragon's blood, which comes from a tree. It's not your own blood.
Okay. it's just something about Samuel Jackson taking it just didn't seem right. Anyway.
Well, now your idea of precision comes into play when you are a luthier. That matters. Raising the bridge a half a millimeter, the adjustment of the angle of the fingerboard, everything about an instrument requires absolute precision.
And yet, the first time I saw a violin maker, Paul Schubach at his shop in Portland, use a small violin maker's tuning plate.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It was like he had an ads, like a wink, a wink, a wink.
That's what you do with tuning plates.
Hammering away at the inside of the back to thin it up to the proper thing.
Yeah.
But I was just astonished. I thought, it'd be all these careful, precise strokes. Nah, he was just hacking away at it.
The precise strokes for creating the scroll.
I think that once you get the hang of your art, your craft, that precision walks with you, whether you want to acknowledge it or not. Through everything that you do, it's just, and that's what informs craftsmanship, I think, is that sense of doing it right, doing it better each time if you can, and staying very precise. That's how you get to the results that you're at.
Yeah.
Tell our audience the difference between French marquetry and what other forms.
Oh, okay. The marquetry, of course, is historic, just briefly goes back forever. Mm-hmm. There's different methods of doing marquetry. The professor I studied under found 5 different methods that he could identify that were historic methods of surface decoration: Tarsia Castro, Tarsia Incertissima, Tarsia Geometrica, Tarsia Atopo, and the 5th one, which is French, So right away, there's a difference between the four that were historic.
Italian,
German, Mediterranean driven processes going back to the Egyptians. And the French method, which is unique to the French and kept secret by them for a long period of time, the classic method. So what the French did that is quite different from everybody else is they cut, they developed a tool, the Chevalier, where they could cut with a horizontal blade and a vertical packet. Every other person, every other trade, country, even outside of Paris in the region of France, they cut with a horizontal packet and a vertical blade.
Right. Typical scroll saw cut.
Either a fret saw or a scroll saw or foot-powered vertical saw or some kind of a saw, jigsaw. So right away you have the difference between the approach to the material. Again, going to pie, because if you have a jigsaw, you're pushing the material into the blade, and the material has a great mass compared to the blade. And so you're manipulating a mass of material against the blade with very little precision. If you have the material in a clamp and all you're manipulating is a 2-aught blade, you're able to move it very, very carefully against the material and very precisely, number one. Number two, you can see what you're doing because it's in front of your face. Number three, the dust falls away, so you don't have to worry about that. Number four, you're clamping it with your feet, which leaves your hand able to manipulate fully the entire packet rather than trying to hold it down and manipulate it against a vertical moving blade. Number four, when you cut out a very precise tiny piece, less than a millimeter in diameter, it's vertical, so it's not falling anywhere. You can grab it and take it out and put it in your tray. Whereas if you do that with a jigsaw, it's going to disappear into the...
Right.
So those are the beginnings of the argument of why the French is a superior method because of the tools and because of the approach between the worker, the tool, and the material.
Right.
But the French methodology, the piece by piece, was designed to eliminate the saw kerf without having to do bevel cutting, which is what most English and other countries decide to do with the horizontal material. They do a bevel cutting, Silas Koff, these guys, so that they can eliminate the saw kerf. Well, it's wasteful of material. The material on top, you can't use again. You get one copy when you're done, and you are constantly cutting it and fitting it and cutting it and fitting it and cutting it and fitting it. So you can't handle very elaborate designs very easily without the risk of breaking it.
Right.
So the French use a perpendicular blade, 90 degrees at all times. How do they get rid of the saw curve, which was the goal of this methodology? Well, they do that by making multiple designs of the pattern so that instead of one drawing glued onto the packet and destroyed during the cutting, they have a dozen copies of that design through a picking machine process or even a Xerox or a computer today making copies of the design. So let's say you have 12 copies of the design. You take the paper and you cut out every one of the leaves, every one of the veins, every one of the elements of the design as a piece of paper. You glue that onto your packet, and that has multiple layers of the same material. So 4 or 6 layers of walnut, 4 or 6 layers of ebony, 4 or 6 layers of whatever material you have for that element. And you cut all those out, and you cut them out by cutting on the clockwise direction around the perimeter of the material. So you have a leaf, you cut clockwise around the leaf, and you cut half the line, which means you're cutting away the outside half of that line. Then when you get all those pieces cut out, you take the same design, you put it on your background material, which also has 4, 6, 8 layers of background material, and you cut out counterclockwise, which means you're now cutting away half the line, but it's the inside half of the line. So therefore, you can make an exact copy multiple copies with no waste to speak of and no curve. And that is what saved marquetry from oblivion, because you can make a profit if you can produce 8 or 10 copies at the same time as one copy over here at Silas's place.
Right.
He has to charge a lot of money for one copy because that's all he made. I can charge 1/5 of that for 5 copies and still get the same amount of money. I just, you know, multiple.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the French marquetry.
Right. And these designs aren't used again in the same picture.
No, yes, they are. When you do a picking of the design, you have a master, which is used to transfer with a bitumen powder to the copies. Hmm. The master, the original, which is picked, is kept in an archive in the workshop. Mm-hmm. So that you can copy that again in the future with very little effort. You just take it out and make more copies. But in the designing of the flowers and the elements, very commonly going back to the Louis XIV period, they would have a flower design that they would use in many different pictures, same flower. Sure. And they would just take that idea and copy it. And so that's why French marquetry looks, if you look at the elements, it looks like it was all done by the same artist, because all the flowers are very similar, all the leaves are very similar, the only thing that's different is the arrangement.
Were your teachers at Ecole Boulle, were they practicing artists or were they just teachers?
Pierre, there's only one market. When I was there, it was Pierre Ramon. And mm-hmm. Pierre wrote the book Marquetry. And he had run the largest marquetry workshop in Paris for about, 20 years as the manager of the workshop. Mm-hmm. And then marquetry in the 60s fell out of fashion.
Of course.
It didn't die. It just, fell out of fashion. And he began to work at Ecole Boulle as a professor. He had a doctorate. And so he ran the workshop very much like he ran the business of managing a dozen or so workers who were all cutting marquetry under his supervision. And he would, as any good manager, he would demonstrate each of the activities for the students to learn. But he was a teacher more than he was a maker.
And
very, very good teacher.
Yeah. Better at that, huh?
Oh, yeah. And I think I'm the same as him. I'm a better teacher than I am a maker. I'm limited by my physical constraints at this point in my life, and I can still teach really well.
Uh-huh.
But I can't do so well.
And you have a massive library. I will call it massive.
Yeah. That's just one wall of books.
Right. Right. I thought, I have a pretty good library. And I came to your shop and looked and went, No, I don't.
I have a similar library at home, which is not marquetry or woodworking, but it's rare books.
Uh-huh.
I like history books.
Uh-huh. Yeah, a real love of history then. How do you pass this along?
Boy, I don't know. I have Patrice, who is my partner and half my age, and he's quite good at what he does. And I have my students that 5% of them may become, professional marquetry people. Mm-hmm. I don't have a lot of hope that a high percentage of the students, most of which are just curious. And at some point, Patrice and I are going to write the book we've always promised to write. That's why I'm envious of you having done so.
On?
You and your workmanship in the age of distractions.
Oh, yeah. No, what's your book going to be on?
Oh, it'll be about French marquetry and the history of marquetry from a maker's standpoint.
Uh-huh. It's an enormous undertaking, I can tell you that.
Yeah.
And worth doing. But it takes over your life.
Well, I've got time now.
Well, you need a deadline. You got a publisher?
Well, Schwartz has always said he'll publish anything I write.
Uh-huh.
Lost Art Press. Right now, I am writing Patrice and I are writing a chapter for a book that's our deadline is December 31st. We participated in a conference at Winterthur Museum in April, and that was about marquetry in today's world. And it brought together a few of the well-known marquetry guys like Silas and Paul Schirsch and others. And so as a result of that conference, Winterthur is publishing a 500-page book where each of us gets a chapter, 4,000 words and a dozen pictures. And I decided to do it in first person. They left it up to us whether it's first person or third person. And so I'm going to have a chance to tell my story about my influences and my trajectory and have that published. That's on the desk right now for December 31st. The other thing I need to do is get back to my blog, because I've sort of let it sit there. And I really enjoy writing on the blog, but I haven't done much in the last year.
Yeah, constant effort. It's it just takes up such an enormous amount of time.
Yeah, but I feel so much better when I do push post, you know, there's something else out there.
Yeah, it's a good feeling. It's just a writing is not like making furniture, and very similar in some respects, but it's not.
Well, that's where I can say I'm creative in use of words. I grew up with a thesaurus next to me at all times. I did a lot of writing in college, and I enjoy putting words together to create concepts. And so in a way, that's like my design of furniture. I take words and I make paragraphs. And when I do furniture, I take elements and I make furniture. It's an assemblage.
Yeah, much the same. My favorite quote about writing is from Elmore Leonard, the mystery guy, suspense guy. You just sit there until the blood forms on your forehead.
For me, it's just start writing. And then about the fifth or sixth paragraph, you've got your opening.
Right. Oh, it's, yeah.
It's not the first thing you write that disappears. It's about fifth or sixth in, you say, wow, this paragraph is a good opening. And you move it up to the top, and that becomes your opening.
Do you write longhand, or you write on the computer?
No, I write on the computer. I'm a typer.
I just spoke with my writing teacher, Mary Dawn Duckler, who's a poet and playwright. She still writes some longhand and likes that, you know, history. And I understand that, but I'm so slow. My brain's going so fast with words that I can't keep.
I can type as fast as I think, but I just cannot write that fast. And
when I try,
I can't read it. Yeah,
exactly. It's all gibberish. Like, who wrote this? This is like one big mess. So, but I find that the writing stuff helps me coalesce ideas and. But it is.
Are you working on anything now?
I'm working on so many things now. I'm working on a group of short stories, children's stories for adults. They're sort of, I say in the beginning, they're all invented. They're completely true. So, but I've been working on that for years. My novel I've put aside. Couldn't sell that. My book on creativity, I put aside, couldn't sell that. So I'm doing some short stories and stuff, and that's a lot of fun. So,
you know, look at Roy Underhill. He tried to write that novel, and it didn't work. Radio Man or some, what was it called?
I don't know.
Well, Roy is a genius in what he does, but you can't do everything, and I would not try to write a novel.
It's hard work. I spent years walking around repeating the plot to myself, just walking. That's no good.
No. That's not going to happen.
I went to a writer's conference in Squaw Valley, and I can't remember his name right now. I sat with him for an hour, my writing teacher, who looked at my entry. You had to submit a chapter. And I submitted chapter 10 and he looked at it, and which I thought was my strongest chapter. And he looked at it and he said, well, maybe you could get rid of this. Get rid of this chapter. I'm like, oh shit, you gotta be kidding me. And then we proceeded to have this really interesting conversation about voice. And I said, well, what about Hemingway, you know? And he's got this voice. He said, yeah, he was from Chicago, but then he was working in Kansas City. And finally, his advice to me was, well, you got to write like you build a piece of furniture.
Oh, boy.
Figure out the parts, put them together like that. So I'm reworking the novel and going to give it another try. It's just one of the great things about writing in trade publications is that it's much more easy to get a publisher, a ready publisher. And that's more than half the battle writing fiction. It's just so hard.
I would not do fiction. Patrice and I just submitted an article that's published in this SAPFM journal that's coming out now. And we went back and forth co-writing with your partner. Mm-hmm. It's quite an experience because you tell him, boy, I got this. This is what we want to say. Oh, no, that's not right. We're going to do it a different, and then we had a third person do copy editing, oh, copywriting. Right. And I found out that I can't keep a tense. I got a vocabulary that you could die for. It's my tense that gets me messed up, and present tense and past tense and future tense. And I just flip around in my tenses, even though the words make sense to me. It's kind of the way I talk. And she went and go, oh, no, we got to change all this. This verb is wrong. And this, I've got adjective strength. I've got noun strength. I have bad verbiage.
I don't know. It depends. I think it depends on the, again, the publisher and the audience. But every time I go to a writing seminar, or listen to somebody pontificate about writing rules, and they say, well, you can't do this and you can't do that. And then you find an example of, some great writer, Borges or Nabokov, and you go, oh, but they did it.
Yeah.
Well, you can't do it unless you're...
Once you're famous, you can do it. Fred Astaire.
Exactly. Then you can do it. I would be remiss if I did not ask you which of those descriptive nouns best fits you. Are you a hustler, a faker, or a thief?
If I admit to stealing designs from previous masters, I'm a thief.
Well, I don't think we're born with these ideas in our head. We open our eyes. We're mimickers.
I only steal from dead people.
And only steal from dead people who have also
famous dead people.
choose wisely. I call it reverent theft. I call design reverent theft.
It's homage. It's homage. Okay.
Homage.
Flattery is the sincerest form.
It can be, not always, but it can be. Well, thanks very much for chatting today. I really appreciate your time, and this was a lot of fun.
We should do this more often.
Okay. I'm game.
I don't mind. It's no pain off my back.
Yeah.
But it's good talking to you, Gary.
And I'm going to look up the Guarneri Quartet.
Yes. Early, middle, and late quartets of Beethoven by the Guarneri. Famous group.
And I know the group.
Do you know the Dover? The Dover Quartet?
No.
They are just as good as the Guarneri, and they studied from the Curtis Institute, and they're working currently on the Beethoven series, but get something by the Dover Quartet, and you'll see what young people can do today. It's amazing.
Uh-huh. How long have you been playing the viola?
When I was in college, I was in the quartet at UCSD and played for a number of years. Then I took 40 years and didn't play, which
is no kidding.
Not a good thing. Yeah. And so about 5 years, 6 years ago, I picked it up again, and I'm struggling to get back to my form. But In my 20s, I was a pretty good instrument player.
It takes such effort. And it's...
Well, I beat my hands up. I don't have the flexibility I had when I was 20.
Right, right.
At least I still have my fingers.
Yes, which is a good thing. Do you do exercises for those or just play?
There's different things you can do to,
right,
you know, squeeze things and stuff like that.
Right. Yeah. Right. Fish oil and all that crap.
But. No, just, I mean, hand sanding is the opposite of therapy. I'm sanding a set of chairs right now, and it just makes my fingers into rigid tools.
That's why we have shop monkeys.
No, I don't.
No, no, you can't pass the work off to someone.
No, it's my work.
Okay.
My name is on it.
I get that. I just think there's some jobs I'm happy to, once I train someone, I'm happy to.
No. Hand that off. When I can't do it anymore, I'll quit.
All right. Well, that'll be a while, I'm sure.
Anyway, good luck.
Thanks. And it's pretty much everything we talked about. So it includes the music stuff and all that. And I think people like that. But I'll get rid of the ums and ahs and scratches and all that stuff.
I don't do
I do.
You go back and check the edit. I don't do
I will check very carefully.
Okay.
Because everyone does. Every once in a while. And you don't even know it's happening. It's just conversation.
I would be surprised if you found a single
I will look for it. No ums. Okay.
No ums. Let me know. I pride myself in that.
And when we get close, whatever information you want to put on the website about your conservator position or the, you know, you take students on into your library, do you not?
We have students. When we have class, we have students. Yes, they use the library.
Okay. And the glue company. And so all the information you want, if you want to post the chapter for the SAPFM, or no, this is the Winter Tour.
Well, the Winter Tour one is not my property once it's submitted.
Okay.
The SAPFM one, I can use a PDF of that after it's been published.
Okay. Well, we can promote it. And provide links and whatever you'd like.
So okay.
Take a look at the creativity-hft.com. You'll see what's up.
What is HFT?
Dash, Hustlers, Fakers, and Thieves, but I didn't want everyone to try and spell that. So creativity-hft.com. And my first guest was from, I think she went to UCSD too. So anyway. She's a metal worker and photographer. Pretty interesting stuff.
Okay.
Thanks, Patrick. This was fun.
Okay. I'm going to sign off now.
All right. Me too.
Bye-bye.
Adios.